From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. U.S. President Barack Obama was scheduled to deliver a televised address about his planned actions against the paramilitary group known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State Wednesday evening. On Tuesday, he spoke by telephone with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon about a number of global issues, including the situation in Iraq and Syria. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
U.S. President Barack Obama and U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon discussed a number of global issues. Ban Ki-moon has recently been making a round of calls on Ebola to regional and global leaders. Stéphane Dujarric, the Secretary General's spokesperson, says that amongst other topics, Mr. Ban and President Obama discussed the need to urgently scale up international efforts to combat the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
The Secretary General informed the President that he was planning to convene a high-level event during the General Assembly to highlight the needs and required response from governments, NGOs, the private sector, as well as academic institutions. The Secretary General welcomed the efforts to build a broad coalition to counter the threat posed by extremists that have occupied large parts of Iraq and Syria. He thanked President Obama for the U.S.'s efforts to assist Iraqis in dire need of humanitarian assistance, especially in areas rendered inaccessible by extremists.
Mr. Dujarric added that Ban Ki-moon also welcomed President Obama's initiative to chair a Security Council session on foreign terrorist fighters during this year's session of the General Assembly. The two leaders also discussed the importance of an effective monitoring mechanism for the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
We'll have more on the situation in Iraq and Syria, including new and/or rehashed claims of Syrian chemical weapons use, later in this newscast. Meanwhile, with the U.S. reportedly poised to re-engage militarily in Iraq and become directly involved in Syria, another member of NATO, France, issued an urgent call for military intervention in Libya. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said Wednesday that the world must act in Libya, which he called a major terrorist hub on Europe's doorstep. France played a key role in the 2011 NATO intervention in Libya that led to the current chaos. In an interview with Le Figaro newspaper, Le Drian said it's time to, quote, sound the alarm about the seriousness of the situation in Libya, closed quote, which he said was now at risk of, quote, falling under jihadist control, closed quote. The government that was installed after the 2011 U.S.-led bombing campaign in Libya controls, literally, not even enough real estate in the country to convene the parliament. A Greek car ferry was hired at the last minute to accommodate the embattled parliament, which has fled the country's civil war to the small eastern town of Tobruk. The Elros liner has been deployed, complete with its Greek crew, as a floating hotel for a legislature clinging to power in the city that is the last stop before the Egyptian border. The small port city is home to what remains of Libya's sovereign power. A variety of competing rebel groups have captured the capital, Tripoli, and most of Benghazi, the country's second city. Derna, the next town up the coast, has been declared an Islamic caliphate by yet another group, and the front line begins at Tobruk Airport, where pickup trucks mounting anti-aircraft guns face out into the empty desert. Moving to Ukraine, Wednesday was the fifth day of the ceasefire in the eastern part of that country, and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko announced that he was considering a possible change of status for Luhansk and Donetsk republics. We have this report from Press TV.
Pro-Russian fighters in eastern Ukraine say they seek independence of areas they've proclaimed republics. That's despite Kiev's pledge to keep them part of Ukraine. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says there will be no such thing as federalization or estrangement of parts of the country. Poroshenko stressed that there will be no concessions on issues of Ukraine's territorial integrity. However, he promised a law that grants greater autonomy to parts of Donetsk and Luhansk, now controlled by pro-Russians. This is while the deputy prime minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic said they are not considering remaining part of Ukraine. 5 months of fighting in eastern Ukraine has left over 2,700 killed. The fighting has also displaced at least 500,000 people.
But not everyone believes that Poroshenko will implement a plan of federalization. World Affairs journalist Neil Clark said that the special status proposal is vague and may simply be a cover for the Ukrainian army to rearm and regroup. He spoke with RT Wednesday.
To be quite honest, when the leaders of the coup took power in Ukraine back in February, had they really wanted to bring the people of the East with them, then they would have offered federalization then, or at least sizable autonomy. But they did absolutely the opposite. They deliberately set out to provoke the people in the East. Remember, one of the first things they did was change the Russian language law, having its official second language status in the East. They then appointed two billionaire oligarchs to govern eastern provinces, and they also reversed the ban on Nazi insignia. So they did everything to actually alienate people in the East and provoke the present crisis. And it's a bit rich now for Poroshenko to come out talking about special status. Had this been announced earlier on, back in February, then 2,000 people's lives would have been saved, perhaps 100,000 people are refugees. And so I think that we've got to look very carefully at the motives of the Kiev authorities in doing this. It's quite clear that their military offensive didn't go well. That's why they signed up to this ceasefire. And the grave suspicion is that they're really using this in order to rearm and regroup to launch an offensive at a later date. That's the worry.
Meanwhile, there have been prisoner exchanges between the two sides. Press TV's Serena Shim has more.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko claimed that pro-Russian rebels had released several hostages. The president, while on a visit to the eastern Ukrainian city of Mariupol, also said that several other soldiers who refused to surrender were also allowed to leave the conflict zone. The release of hostages from both sides of the conflict was part of the ceasefire negotiated in Minsk on Friday.
Despite allegations by officials that the ceasefire is still holding, casualties have been reported on both sides of the conflict. After the release of hundreds of hostages by the pro-Russian fighters, Kiev says it is now preparing to secure the release of 500 more.
Moscow hopes within the next few days the ceasefire will be consolidated. We naturally rely on the opinions of the OSCE observers. They aren't panicking. They do acknowledge that there are some isolated incidents from both sides.
Former Ukrainian military officer Alexei Arestovich said although the ceasefire was being held, he thinks the war will resume around the 20th of September.
The data released by the presidential administration says they released 700 hostages, both civilian and military. But in all, the hostages are around 1,400. It is still unknown if all hostages will be freed.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also said he was concerned there was a buildup of Ukrainian troops in the east of the country, and that he hopes concrete negotiations will start quickly between Kiev and representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Serena Shim, Press TV, Kiev.
Tuesday saw an overwhelming response from the international community to a recent U.S. court decision that ordered Argentina's government to pay more than $1 billion to a group of so-called vulture fund investors who purchased debt instruments issued by the Latin American country that were in default. Argentina had defaulted in its international debt payments in 2002, but had reached terms to restructure and repay the monies with more than 92% of the paper's holders. The vulture funds, which purchased the debt for mere pennies on the dollar, were holding out for full repayment at the original terms. A U.S. district court sided with the funds, and that decision was affirmed on appeal, with the U.S. Supreme Court refusing to hear a challenge. But on Tuesday, the U.N. General Assembly passed a strongly worded resolution establishing a new legal framework to guide countries restructuring their debts in cases like Argentina's and the vulture funds. 124 countries voted in favor of the proposal, with only 11 voting against and 41 abstentions. Among those voting against the proposal were the U.S., the U.K., Germany, Israel, and Japan. The new reform could empower poor countries against predatory funds and limit future defaults. This was Sacha Laurenti Solis, the current president of the G77 plus China, who also serves as the permanent representative of Bolivia to the UN, introducing the resolution at the General Assembly Tuesday.
Today, Mr. President, I have the honor to make this introduction on behalf of the Group of 77 and China. And I would like to begin by expressing my thanks for the commitment of all member states of the group and also to those other states who helped to improve this very important resolution, showing genuine commitment to build an international financial system in which the rules are just and favorable towards development, as well as demonstrating a general global alliance so that developing countries will be able to achieve sustainable development. I'd also like to thank the representatives of member states together with us today, and in particular thank the Foreign Minister of the Argentine Republic, Mr. Hector Timmermans, for being with us. Mr. President, in this context, the G77 and China would like to introduce the draft resolution A/68/L57(1), entitled Towards the Establishment of a Multilateral Legal Framework for Sovereign Debt Restructuring Processes. The resolution in the resolution part stresses, amongst other things, the importance of a timely, effective, understandable, and lasting solution to the problems of debt for developing countries in order to promote their growth and economic growth in an inclusive manner. It calls for an intensification of efforts to prevent debt crises by improving international financial mechanisms for prevention and resolution of crises in cooperation with the private sector, with a view to finding solutions acceptable to all. And it decides to draw up design an intergovernmental negotiating process as a matter of priority during the 69th session, a multilateral framework for restructuring of sovereign debt, with a view, amongst other things, to increase the efficiency, stability, and the predictability of the international financial system and to bring about sustainable economic growth that is fair and inclusive for sustainable development in accordance with national circumstances and priorities. It also decides to define the modalities for intergovernmental negotiations and the adoption of the multilateral legal framework in the main part of the 69th session before the end of 2014. Mr. President, there is a debate underway. This has been the case now since 1970 as to whether the international financial system requires a mechanism to address the restructuring of sovereign debt. 12 years ago, at the first Financing for Development conference held in Monterrey, our leaders expressed their commitment to work on towards an international mechanism for renegotiating debt. A similar commitment was made at the second financing conference in Doha in 2008, and also at the end of the 2009 conference, we reaffirmed the need, and I quote, to explore improved approaches for restructuring sovereign debt, end of quotation. And currently, a committee of experts nominated by the president of the last session on with regard to specific recommendations for an international bankruptcy court. And also, for many years, the Secretary General, in his reports on sustainability and development and debt, has continued to insist on the need to address this issue and has made recommendations on the establishment of a specific mechanism. And UNCTAD also has been examining the matter since the end of the 70s. During the last decade, the G77 and China has been putting forward proposals for the establishment of a legal framework on the restructuring of sovereign debt. In last June, in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, President, the heads of state and government of the G77 and China agreed and I quote, "The urgent need for the international community to examine options for a mechanism, an international resolution mechanism for effective debt that is fair, lasting, independent, and oriented towards development." And end of quotation. And once again, I quote, "called upon all countries to promote and contribute to debates in the United Nations and other fora with regard to this objective," end of quotation. Mr. President, as the recent report of the Secretary General indicates, the recent debt crises and the protracted holdout bondholder litigations against Argentina have led to intensified international debate on the need for a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism to improve efficiency, fairness, and coordination in sovereign debt restructuring. Today, it is Argentina, but many developing and developed countries as well have suffered before from the exact same predatory behavior, and others will follow if we do not act. The debt problem and debt restructuring is not merely a financial, judicial, or even a jurisdictional problem. It is a problem that concerns the whole world and all countries, both developed as well as developing. It has to do with growth, it has to do with development, and it has to do with human rights. The lack of a structured mechanism is a major failure of the current international financial architecture, which leads, among other issues, Mr. President, to long delays in debt restructuring, to unfair outcomes, and loss of value for both debtors and creditors, Mr. President. The international community must realize that no path to growth can be pursued or fostered with unsustainable debt overhang. As such, any debt restructuring exercise should have as its core element a determination of real repayment capacity. If the real repayment capacity of any country is not properly addressed, the original restructuring may require more time for further restructuring. Such outcome might further affect growth and good faith creditors. Mr. President, the Group of 77 in China expresses deep concern about vulture fund litigation. Debt restructuring processes and debt sustainability itself are at present facing serious risks related to the actions of speculators endeavoring to make excess profits from countries facing excessive debt obligations and repayment processes, therefore placing them in vulnerable situations. Indeed, sovereign debt management has been a crucial issue for developing countries, both as a source for concern in past decades and as a strong point in more recent years due to the activities of vulture funds. Recent developments and examples of vulture funds' actions have revealed their speculative and profit-seeking nature. These vulture funds pose a risk for all future debt restructuring processes, both for developed and developed countries. I'd like to repeat that last sentence. These vulture funds pose a risk for all future debt restructuring processes. The Group of 77 and China believes that vulture funds must not be allowed to paralyze the debt restructuring efforts of developing countries, and that these funds should not supersede a state's right to protect its people under international law. Mr. President, recent developments have also proved that market-based ad hoc contractual approaches to working out sovereign debt are insufficient to deal with debt crises, thereby leading to cascades of litigation and causing ripple effects throughout the debt market. As we have said, The situation that we are facing today affects all developing and developed countries and demonstrates that the market approach has failures and gaps that need to be urgently addressed. Mr. President, the G77 and China wishes to reaffirm that the United Nations is the organization with the central role and necessary legitimacy to deal with these issues, development and related issues, and reiterates that the UN is the appropriate venue. This, the General Assembly, is the appropriate venue, Mr. President, to discuss the economic and financial affairs and decide on the best follow-up and alternatives to meet the needs and challenges of the 21st century. The systemic problems facing the global economy have yet to be resolved. There are still major and unfulfilled objectives, and all efforts in this area must be intensified. We cannot afford to remain as spectators until another case arises, and we once again are reminded of the need to take action on this issue. In conclusion, Mr. President, I would like to express particular thanks here to the Republic of Argentina. Because of Argentina, the international community is having its eyes opened to an enormous risk, and that is why the Group of 77 and China is tabling this resolution for adoption by this General Assembly. Thank you very much.
As the world waited Wednesday to see what type of military action the U.S. was planning to take against ISIL, ISIS, Islamic State, and in which country or countries, it appeared that there was a vigorous public relations campaign to couch the U.S. attacks on Syrian territory, at least partially, in the context of allegations that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons. A curiously timed press release issued Wednesday by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or the OPCW, claimed, quote, there was compelling confirmation that a toxic chemical was used systematically and repeatedly as a weapon in villages in northern Syria earlier this year, closed quote. According to the press release, quote, the report says chlorine was used in attacks on the villages of Talmains, Al-Tamana, and Kafr Zeta, all located in northern Syria. In May this year, the FFM had attempted to visit Kafr Zeta to gather on-site evidence in the aftermath of an alleged use there, but was prevented from doing so when the convoy was attacked. The FFM then decided to carry out witness interviews in a safe location outside of Syria, closed quote. The actual report was not available at either the UN or OPCW websites as of press time Wednesday, and although the press release does not indicate who is alleged to have conducted the chlorine attacks, the UN News Service reported it in the context of an alleged attack in August of last year that the U.S. blamed on the Syrian government at the time. UN reporter Stephanie Kutrix filed that report Wednesday.
There is compelling confirmation that a toxic chemical was used as a weapon in Syria, according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. The OPCW fact-finding mission, appointed to examine alleged uses of chemical weapons in northern Syria, says the substance was used systematically and repeatedly. The mission says it is able to conclude with a high degree of confidence that chlorine, pure or in mixture, is the toxic chemical. At least 1,400 people were gassed to death in the suburbs of Damascus in August 2013, and spates of new allegations have taken place since then. This is the second report of the OPCW, whose first fact-finding mission results were published last June. This new report now presents key findings from dozens of interviews with victims, first responders, and eyewitnesses to the attacks. The fact-finding mission is reportedly continuing its investigation. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
It was also not reported who was alleged to have conducted the raids against the FFM as they attempted to do the inspections in May. The allegations against the Syrian government were widely reported around the globe last year, but a subsequent report by chemical weapons experts from the Russian Federation, based upon actual forensic evidence collected at the site, concluded that the attack was conducted by the rebels fighting the government. That report got scant attention from Western media. Nevertheless, as the world waited on Wednesday to hear from President Obama, Western media was again repeating the allegations against the Syrian government as if they were facts. In one example, Wednesday's New York Times, in an article entitled "Obama Ready to Authorize Airstrikes on ISIS in Syria," contained the following statement. Referring to President Obama, the Times article reads, quote, "When he threatened Syria with a missile strike last year, after Mr. Assad's forces used chemical weapons, implacable opposition in Congress led him to shelve the plan. Now, however, the threat from ISIS has changed both the American political climate and his calculations," closed quote. But when State Department spokesperson Marie Harf was grilled by reporters Wednesday, her responses were less than illuminating and conspicuously lacking in terms of facts and evidence.
"We believe that by the time we wake up tomorrow, that area from Tel Afar in Iraq all the way down to Raqqa and down to Deir ez-Zor would be bombarded in Syria."
"I don't have anything on the specifics in the president's speech to preview for you."
"Yes. On this coalition against ISI, do you have the list of countries which have confirmed they are part of this international coalition?"
"Well, let's be clear what we're talking about when we talk about a coalition. This is not what I think some people traditionally think of as a military coalition. This is a group of countries let me finish and then you can follow up. That will do things like provide military support to our Iraqi partners. A number of countries are already doing that. To stop the flow of foreign fighters. Obviously, we work with countries around Iraq and Syria on that. Countering ISIL's funding and financing. We've talked about working with Gulf partners, particularly to cut off some of the private citizen funding. Working with other countries in the ransom issue to cut off that funding. Addressing the humanitarian crisis and delegitimizing ISIL's ideology. These are all parts of that."
"Yeah.
So obviously we have a broad list of who has pledged publicly to support some aspect of fighting ISIL. And hopefully we can share some of that with you. So we're putting together this list, but I want to make sure people are clear that we're not talking about a purely military coalition, as I think in the past, particularly with the last Iraq situation, that's what was really focused on."
"So can you give us a list or the number of countries which are part of this
coalition?" "We're working on putting all of that together. There are a number of countries who've said things publicly, so as we can provide that, we will provide that to you." Yes, James?
"By way of corrective, when you suggest that the Iraq conflict that was presided over by Mr. Bush and Cheney involved a coalition that was exclusively military."
"Not exclusively, but I think when people use the term coalition of the willing, that's what they were referring to."
"Okay."
"And it was colloquially became known as something that was military, I think in its usage."
"The Japanese, for example, were participants in that coalition and were not participating with military assets, correct?"
I don't remember the exact Japanese participation in that, but I think when people colloquially use that word, they tend to think of military, and I just want to be clear about that.
Just a quick follow-up on the meeting that is going to take place tomorrow in Jeddah. The ambassador, the Russian ambassador to Lebanon, said that the people that should be there are not there, namely Iran, Syria, and Russia. Do you believe that this is basically
meeting.
This is a U.S.-friendly meeting? It's not including everybody that is fighting that war against terror?
First, this is a meeting of specific countries, particular GCC partners, on this issue. It is not the only meeting by any means we will have on this. There will be a number of meetings, for example, at the UN General Assembly, including a Security Council session the president will chair on foreign fighters. So I would venture to guess all members of the Security Council will likely be there. So that includes at least one of those countries you just mentioned. But we are not going to work with the Assad regime to fight ISIS. We've been clear about that. And when it comes to Iran, we're not going to be coordinating with them. We are open to having conversations with them, but I don't have any preview for you on what that might look like.
But by default, when you strike ISIS positions, and so does the Syrian regime, aren't you really basically on the same side, targeting the same enemy?
No, we said we are not making common cause with the Assad regime here. That while we may at times be targeting members of the same terrorist organization, the Syrian regime is the reason they've been allowed to flourish, and indeed the reason they've grown so strong, not just in Syria, but also in Iraq. So we will not be making common cause with them, and they are not the solution here either to the ISIS problem.
So given that, and the position that you will have nothing to do with the Assad regime, how much more important does that, or how much importance does that place on support for the moderate opposition?
Absolutely. It's a key part of our strategy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.